Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in Anthropology, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Reagan Gillum, a host on the channel, and today I'm talking to Dr. Victoria Reyes, who is the author of the book Academic Outsider, Stories of Exclusion and Hope, published by Stanford University Press. Dr. Reyes, welcome to the podcast.
Reagan, thank you so much for having me. I'm so honored to be invited, and please call me Victoria.
Great, I will do just that. So we're here to talk about your book, Academic Outsider, which uses your lived experiences and research to talk about exclusion in the academy. But before we went into that, I wanted you to be able to just tell us a little bit about yourself. And I also wanted you to also tell us a little bit about your research that you've done, because you're also the author of the book Global Borderlands, published by Stanford University Press. So I wondered if you could talk a little bit about the research that you've done, as well as anything you want to share with us to introduce yourself.
Sure, thanks. So I guess I'll just start with the book since you mentioned it. Yeah, my first book is called Global Borderlands, Fantasy, Violence, and Empire in Subic Bay, Philippines. It came out the second half of 2019. And so sometimes I forget that it was also like the publicity for it was impacted by COVID just because it was right beforehand. But here I really draw on ethnography, archives, interviews, legal documents to really study Subic Bay, Philippines as a particular kind of place, right? I'm really interested in legally plural and legally ambiguous places like military bases, tourist resorts, colonial trading forts, special economic zones, international branch campuses, right, where these laws are legal and plural. And in the book, I document and talk about and theorize how this affects all aspects of life, right? Not just, for example, laws, although I go into that. And I use Subic Bay was a home of a former U.S. Subic Bay naval base in the Philippines. The U.S. military withdrew in 1992. It became a special economic zone. And here in each chapter, I really do this comparison between the military base and the Freeport zone in matters of law and jurisdiction in terms of money and authority, right? Kind of trade and who has access, who controls air, space. I'm really interested in taxes, although not a lot of people are, through two criminal cases of U.S. servicemen who, content warning for listeners, who commit sexual violence against Filipino women, talk about kind of romance between foreigners and Filipino women, and as well as kind of children, how they play a role in these legally ambiguous places and working consumption. And so it's a book that kind of touches upon a lot of work, and it's really about this particular kind of place and how it's a place made up of several social worlds and the ways in which legal ambiguity plays a role and thinking about sovereignty and how that shapes intimate relations as well as consumption patterns. In terms of me, we'll probably get through this in some of the questions since Academic Outsider is a personal story. It's about me. you know, my mom was 15 when she had me. Mom and my family, my maternal family is from the Philippines. My grandma came over to the U.S. through marriage to a U.S. serviceman. She left my mom in the Philippines until she was about 7 and brought her over. And my mom had me when she was 15 years old. So my grandma raised me, and I'm very lucky to have my grandma now help me raise my kids. And I have an 8-year-old and a 4-year-old. I'm a sociologist. I got a PhD in sociology, but I recently transferred to a gender and sexuality studies department. And I'm really excited in part because I think that this book may find a better home, or at least maybe a better home or a better fit with interdisciplinary work when disciplinary conventions would traditionally exclude it.
Yeah, thank you. I think that definitely the book will find a home interdisciplinarily, and I think it'll really speak to a lot of different readers and types of readers who pick it up. I myself was very taken with the entire book, and so I can begin, I guess, with the title of the book, which is Academic Outsider, and you define that as being, quote, separated from other academics and from university life more generally by our lived experiences. And I wondered what brought you to write this book, Academic Outsider, and how did you develop this idea or this term, Academic Outsider?
Yeah, thank you. And first, thank you so much for your kind words. This is a really raw and vulnerable book. Really what brought me to writing this was the COVID shutdowns. My solo parent, 2 kids, as I mentioned, they just recently turned 8 and 4. They were my daughter Olivia was in kindergarten, and James, my son, had just started preschool right before the shutdowns. But before even the shutdowns, the September before the COVID shutdowns in March 2020, my grandma had a heart attack, and it's just the 4 of us. And that really kind of shifted my whole world because she was my rock, and also because, I mean, she was watching James all day, and, you know, I was the one when she had her heart attack kind of picking up and doing all the kind of care work associated, you know, after she got out of the hospital. And then she had pancreatitis and taking her doctor's appointments on all of this. And so I had to enroll James into preschool. And so he was there starting, I think, in October. And then just a few months later, the March 2020 shutdowns, and, you know, my daughter, kindergarten, she had to do virtual kindergarten. James was back at home, and at my life, everyone else's lives mostly completely turned upside down. And Olivia stayed virtual also for the following school year because my grandma is immunocompromised, and there was no vaccine. And in some ways, I'm very lucky to have her here. But those 18 months were so incredibly hard. That first summer, especially summer 2020, I don't know, Olivia, you know, she has some ADHD characteristics. And, you know, she would be under her bed, virtual school, hanging upside down from her loft bed. And so we actually share a room. I live in a townhouse in Riverside, and so me and Olivia share a room, and James and Grandma share a room. And I couldn't concentrate on my empirical work anymore. I couldn't do anything. I felt like I was just drowning. I felt like I just couldn't do anything anymore. Especially, you know, the pandemic. And you know, Olivia's so sweet. She said that one of the first things she had missed about coming home is she missed giving her teachers hugs. But it's also hard, you know, she would have these screaming, just fits and yelling. And I'm surprised we didn't get the cops called on us. Luckily we had different neighbors, because I've actually had the cops called on us before for James. but that's a different sort of thing. And so this, the very first draft of this book came about in summer 2020. And the On Love and Worth essay, which really goes, is probably the most, it feels the most personal to share. I couldn't revise it because it was so personal. So any revision to that was because of my developmental editor, but really it just poured out of me. So I was like, I need to write because otherwise I don't know what I can do. I suffer from chronic depression. And so I've had therapy for decades on and off. And I take an antidepressant, but my whole, how I cut myself together, right? My life beforehand was a very structured, very on top of things, very kind of scheduled, meticulous, and the pandemic just shattered and crashed all of that. And so this book, so my other project went out, everything else went out. And this is where I poured my thoughts, my thinking. I was also in a very kind of toxic department. And some people were very understanding that I was a single mom of two. Others weren't so understanding. And I would get emails about why I didn't answer an email in the summer on a Friday, on a Monday, right? So over the weekend. So this book is the result of that. Right? The book is the result of me trying to come to terms and thinking and writing and getting all of these emotions and thoughts and working them out on paper. All right, that was a very long answer. And so your second part of that question was, how do you come to develop this term, right? So part of it is I've been reading a lot and really drawn to Black feminism. I'm not a Black woman, right? My family is from the Philippines, but Audre Lorde's Sister Outsider was so incredibly spoke to me. It's not the first time I read the book in 2020, but you know how you read things over and over, you read things more than once, and each time or at different points in your life, they hit you in different ways, right? Like they speak to you in different ways. And that's what was happening. And I was just so inspired by kind of thinking about this is as structural, right? Gendered racism, intersectionality, thinking about Kimberly Crenshaw, Patricia Hill Collins, and Patricia Hill Collins' work on Outsider Within, too, is really influential in thinking about the ways in which I experience the academy. And so that's part of, so Academic Outsider as the title, as a concept, is an homage to Audre Lorde. It's also, an homage to Patricia Hill Collins and Outsider Within.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. I love that, coming to terms with all of these things that are happening, because that sounds like a very difficult time. And it was difficult for all of us, but everyone experiences it differently and for different reasons. And, I like writing as a way of coping with that difficulty. Sounds really powerful. And as you said, the book is very, vulnerable, and it's full of all of these personal stories that you shared. And I really appreciated some of the moments you included in the book, for example, about how people like made you feel like an academic outsider. And I share this too. I probably would also be an academic outsider. I'm a Black woman and a woman of color. And so this resonated with me when you talk about going to like social events with other faculty and saying, quote unquote, the wrong thing during casual conversations, and people respond with like puzzled faces. People are constantly communicating through their reactions. They're shutting down conversations. They're giving these facial expressions that communicate that, one doesn't belong. And I like this because it made me think, well, how does one know that one is an academic outsider? And then it's like, well, through these different interactions. And then you also share these personal experiences that you just talked about growing up and with raising your children. And so I wondered why it was important for you to share these experiences throughout the book, or if you wanted to talk about your use of the personal in the book.
Yeah, thank you for that. I think part of your kind of question and the preface to it in terms of being able to kind of empathize and see these similar microaggressions, right, that occur, and the stopping people in their tracks or facial expressions, et cetera. Like, it's not unique to me. And part of why it's so important to share these experiences is because sometimes, you know, it, so sorry, I also think very circularly. So this is why my answers are kind of not very linear. But in the former department I was in, you know, I constantly felt like I was being gaslighted, right? Or that I was not living in the same reality as people who were in positions of power, as if I did not just hear what was being said, as if these conversations did not just happen. And part of it is, like, again, these, the kind of interactions that I describe are not unique to me. I'm not the first one to be writing about it. Like, there's a long history of women of color, feminisms in particular, about academic experiences. And so for me, it was a way to also just work out and share with the world, and again, getting it out of me, right? So processing through writing. I love to write. I actually love being an academic, right? I love writing, research. I love mentoring. I love teaching. I love service work, right? People tell me I shouldn't say that, but I do. I feel like I can make a difference. But what I don't like is how people are treated. I don't like how I've been treated. I don't like kind of the politics. And so, you know, it's important for me to share these experiences, and I want to, but at the same time, to be honest, I'm terrified. I'm terrified. I want people to read this book, and I'm simultaneously terrified, because these are the kinds of things you're just not supposed to talk about, even though so many of us experience it, right? And so, you know, and everything for me as an ethnographer, you know, as sociology is similar to anthropology, for me, it's, you know, almost kind of odd to some people that the more specific you are, the more general you can be, right? So rooting kind of my experiences in very specific examples of what I'm talking about, people can see in those specific examples more clearly rather than in general terms. The other thing is that, you know, I really appreciate, and, you know, you might be asking this later, so I apologize. I really appreciate that there's been this long history of, like, these edited volumes that come out. The most recent comes to mind, and I really love it, is Black Feminist Sociology by Zakiya Luna and Whitney Pirtle. You have Presumed Incompetent, volumes 1 and 2. You have so many of these different volumes. And it felt like slices of people's lives, right? And I know people had so many more stories. So I wanted to build and kind of theoretically talk about how it impacted all parts of my life, right? The separation between the academic and the personal, just like the political and the personal, is false, right? What happens to me inside the university, inside the building, is the same things that happen to me outside. And so this division between academia and the world outside, there is no division, right? Feeling like an outsider is in the world is also feeling like an outsider in academia. The other thing that I wanted to say, and sorry, I know this is a long answer, is part of this is, you know, as we're going in 2020, 2021, now 2022, right? I keep reading these advice columns, or I would read these reports, or read on Twitter all of the ways that we can kind of be even more efficient in time management, the ways we can reach out and we could do this and do that. And I was like, I can't do anything more, right? That it just wasn't about me. So in many cases, like, just seeing, right, all of these things happening and then being told, like, it's up to me to fix it, or I'm just not having, you know, good time management. It just broke me again, and it shattered me, and it kind of also brushed off, or like made more weak my level of, I don't want to say being silent, because I am not silent even before the COVID pandemic. I speak out, and I get that from the women in my family, but I just would tolerate a lot more things, I think. And I just, in academia, and I think the pandemic has just kind of erased a lot of that ability to tolerate certain things.
Mm-hmm. I know, absolutely. And no, I liked what you were saying about the advice columns as well. And I think you mentioned that in the book. And it, you know, there's this idea that, you know, if people are just told what to do, then, you know, then everything will be okay. And, but it's like, no, because that might help, but ultimately you run into these structural issues, and the way in which the rules can be applied in different ways, that can really trip you up. And so as I was reading your book, I had some different, you know, revelations for myself. And I've been in the, you know, academy for quite, not the longest, obviously, in the world, but for quite some time. And I've generally felt like discomfort in the academy, which you talk about in the book, and it's, you know, in ways related to race and gender. And I had realized that I felt discomfort, but what I realized when I was reading your book was that that you connect this discomfort to the way in which worth and value are constantly being assessed. And I'm just going to quote from you. You write on page 41, I had to prove my worth and value every time I met new people and changed roles, institutions, and stages in my career. To be an outsider, a racialized outsider, is to be uncomfortable. It means never letting your guard down, especially with people who you don't completely trust. And so I wondered if you could talk about some of the ways that you see, you know, worth and value. How is it being assessed, or how do we understand it in the university?
Yeah, thank you for this. I think, again, this was another one moment where kind of the separation between like my personal and my work, you know, I feel like before I would try to be very, you know, particular, and it's separate, and, you know, there are these different boxes in which I fill, right? And the pandemic was like, nope, that's not the case. But I, you know, I talk about in the book, and again, if I start like my voice going, then I start to tear up, just FYI. I mean, I've shared some things on Facebook, and I like start crying when I read comments about like whatever. So again, this is very sensitive, but you know, I talk about it in the book. It's not a secret anymore. You know, my mom had me. I'm a product of rape, and not just once, but multiple times, and molestation. And so, you know, I grew up, and she would tell me that she wished I was never born, I should have been aborted, that I was a bad seed, you know, and sometimes she'd apologize or not. And even, you know, as adults, we would get into these big fights, and all of, you know, I had a very tumultuous relationship with my mom, and she died of breast cancer in 2018. So I've been working through a lot of my emotions with her and her death. But, and this is where I've gone to therapy, you know, a lot, and realizing, you know, that I have sought, what I like about academia is I felt like, okay, there are these sets of rules. If I do these rules, then, you know, it's a meritocracy. And of course, we know intellectually it's not, but, you know, I feel like if I just did everything right, and if I do get this on my CV, or I do this, or I do that, I could finally feel like I'm worthy, that I'm valued, that I mean something. And again, something about the pandemic just showed me the parallels in academia, where I feel like love and worth are just assessed in so many different ways. And part of this is also, you know, I think the UC system, as you know, is unique in that, I think unique, often that junior faculty or assistant professors can be in on merit and promotion discussions, right? That you're able to see files, you discuss them, even though you may not have tenure, et cetera. And so when I started at UCR, and it's not my first job, I was at Bryn Mawr College beforehand, you know, I'm seeing this in the ways people are talked about, in the different ways people are assessed. And really, you know, it's academic politics, right? In terms of someone likes someone, they'll say all the ways they like them, even if they don't have awards, even if they don't publish an XYZ. Someone doesn't like someone, even if they have awards, even if they have et cetera, they're still never good enough, right? There are all these ways to kind of poke holes. And then it's like you see that in hiring and merits, promotions, you know, you see that in these everyday interactions, you know, whether it's as a faculty member or as a postdoc. And I was a postdoc, I think, in that example from the book, where I was talking to this famous person and I was just kind of dismissed. It also occurs in colleagues as grad students. You know, there's a story I tell in the book about, you know, the first time I smoked crack, right? Like I'm a very different person than I was decades ago. And I had, you know, the story I tell in the book and what happened is we were reading a book and oh my gosh, the name is escaping me, but I said it was very evocative to this respected faculty member. And they were like, oh, like you would know. And in fact, I had smoked crack before. In fact, I have tried acid. In fact, I have family members who, you know, been arrested for kidnapping and for drugs and dog fighting, all of these things. And so when there are these like, and really what this person said is seeped in anti-Blackism, right? Anti-Black racism, because I, as, you know, a mixed Filipina American, didn't seem like the kind of person, right? And so it's those ways in which you're stopped in your track and you realize people put you in boxes and they decide whether or not it's worthy or not. Even R&Rs, right? Like editors have to decide who is going to get the revise and resubmit, who doesn't. And, you know, we've all heard these stories about, well, a famous advisor wants their student to be published there. So then they let other people know. And it's all these backstage kind of politics. And so, you know, but it also starts at admissions and how, like, graduate student applications are evaluated. And when people's letter writers who are from top and prestigious programs are given more weight than letters writers who aren't, right? All of that is assessments of love, worth, and also are racialized and gendered in many ways. So it was just kind of me thinking about all of these things and coming out. And so I really think it's part of how we evaluate in all aspects of our work. And, you know, I think that sometimes people don't, and sorry, you may be getting at this later, people don't think of academia as a workplace, but it is, right? And this understanding of who is worthy and who is not, even kind of shapes our syllabi, shapes general exams, these reading lists, right? And you know, oftentimes, you know, my work cuts across so many different subfields, right? Global sociology, economic sociology, urban sociology, law and society, race, ethnicity, gender, etc. But, you know, my work isn't recognized as like X thing. So let me give you an example. So I recently just wrote a piece and it, you know, often since, you know, the hashtag, as you know, Black Lives Matter has long before 2020, but and again, the content warning for your listeners, but the murder of George Floyd really re-brought awareness to mainstream U.S. and globally to kind of anti-Black violence and murders. And in this moment, a lot of sociologists have said, and I'm sure in other disciplines, oh, we need to study race more. We need to study racism, right? And so there was this paper and it called for new directions and, you know, for economic sociology of race. And what they do, these co-authors, is say, well, you know, we should study labor markets and we should study this, we should study that. But that's not the case, right? Like, that's another way of when we write and who we cite, citation politics are kind of conveyors of whose writings we value and who's not. Because in fact, tons of people, sociologists, but also non-sociologists, have written about race and economic life. And so I wrote this book, this article that's published in Sociology Compass called For Du Boisian Economic Sociology, and say that if we really want to reckon with the racism in the discipline, what we need to do is actually go back before we can move forward. And we need to recognize people who we have excluded. And we need to read beyond elite journals, elite books, to orient our arguments. Otherwise, you continue to erase, particularly scholars of color, and many marginalized faculty who have long been writing about this, but because they aren't published in these top outlets, their writings aren't seen as valued. So anyway, so sorry, that was a long tangent about value and worth, but I really think that it's about everything, right? And how kind of academia is structured, especially since it's so structured around peer review.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that was perfect. Your answer. It was great because it connects all of these different levels. And it really, and as you say, these kind of conversations sometimes can happen in sort of back rooms in a way, or places that aren't as visible. And so it produces this like, this shaky ground for many of us, and we don't know where to step constantly. And then, you know, can produce these, like you talk about, of being an academic outsider, because you don't know which way to turn in a way. And so I thought that was a great answer. And then in the book, you also, you kind of began your answer talking about this, where you talked about, you know, your children and the pandemic. But you talk about, you know, academic motherhood, particularly for women of color. And then, as you said, you also talk about it during the COVID-19 pandemic. And so I wondered if you wanted to say any more about how being a mother, particularly of small children, relates to being an academic outsider.
Yeah, in so many ways, I think, you know, because I think just the structure of the modern university, and again, I don't think that I'm the first person to say this, isn't built for mothers. It's built for single white men or married white men who have wives, who take care of the house, who take care of children, who then do editing for them on their books and their articles. You know, if you read acknowledgments, right, that's what you often see. And all of this kind of unrecognized, unpaid labor that goes on in the household. And I think that, you know, being a mother kind of shapes it in all aspects, you know, because one is you're supposed to get, you know, parental leave, if you qualify for FMLA, or, you know, I'm lucky I technically started at UCR before I began on campus. I started and then took a postdoc somewhere else. And so by the time I was pregnant with my second child, I was able to qualify for UCR and kind of because they had like a year long, sorry, I'm blanking on the name, transitionary period, right? Before you could use it. And it's everything from scheduling courses, right? And thinking about, you know, I'm a solo parent and my grandma can't drive. And so I'm the one who has to pick up and drop off my kids every day. And so I can't teach at 7. I can't have meetings at 6. I can't have meetings at 5. To kind of thinking about, you know, I've had these Twitter exchanges where some people will be like, well, why don't you just, you know, when you get asked to do a review or you ask to do an R&R, just drop everything and look at that. And like, well, that's not so easy, right? Because women, particularly women of color, also have a lot of service requirements. You have, having kids, for one, taught me to be very efficient because you are responsible for so many things. And you can't just drop everything in order to kind of do emails or exchanges or go to conferences. Something I'm learning now, my kids are still young, but Olivia is going to be starting third grade. And now I have to think about, I can't necessarily say yes to talks that I'm asked for. Because last year, so she was back in person, she missed school. I used to take her when she was very young. I used to take her, James, and my grandma with me to conferences. So they would go to, you know, New Orleans, Seattle, like wherever I went, I took them. And I just ate the cost of my credit card debt. I have a lot of credit card debt. But last year, and this is when like I took her to Albuquerque for a conference. And then if I'm not here, my grandma doesn't drive. And then my grandma at that point was like, I don't really trust anyone else. She'll just stay home. So she didn't go to school when I was out of town. And then I get a letter from California, state of California and Riverside Unified School District. Well, too many unexcused absences. You could pay a fine, et cetera, et cetera. And so now I'm like, oh, do I need to hire? How can I find someone to hire to take my kids to and from school if, you know, I'm giving a talk on a Friday and I'm flown out on a Thursday and she can't just stay at home? And then maybe it's not worth it because I don't have a second person who can take up the slack. It's just me, you know, it's just me who does a lot of things. And so then I'm like, well, if it's one time, maybe I can ask one of my friends from Olivia's school, my parent friends, and that would be fine. But I can't ask them for that all the time. So, you know, especially being a solo parent, like I just, you know, my kids are in the background. Like I just think like, then it's extra tickets, or then you have to think about field work, you know, like there's all of these ways in which that it shapes so many things. And even just being pregnant, you know, shapes how students see you in the classroom. And, you know, I'm sure there's a lot more I could say, but I know you have a lot of other questions, but that just came to mind because this is something I'm trying to work out now because I'm, you know, I was invited to give a talk in September, invited to give another talk somewhere in October, but I have to say no in part because like, and especially if honorarium aren't very much, like I just, is it worth it to then like try to figure out this care or not go to school? What can I do? And what's hard is, you know, all of these things, A, are not only good for my career, right? And in evaluations, you're like, oh, this person was invited to give this many book talks or from these prestigious universities from here and here, right? So it's part of just like how we provide and document our worth and value as academics. But it's also, it can be fun. It's exhausting. It's emotionally exhausting and physically exhausting. But often, like, especially if I know someone at the place, even if they're not in the department, I can kind of have coffee or like you have dinner with people. But then I get to, you know, thinking about my kids and all of the kind of hassle and arranging and all of this stuff. I'm like, I don't, you know, my grandma's like, it's not worth it. So like, why, you know, it's not worth it because what are we going to do? And so I sorry to go on and on, but this is something like I literally just had a conversation with her like 2 days ago and I don't know what I'm going to do. But that's one example.
Yeah, no, that's a great example. And it's so, so difficult in the way that it compounds all of these different issues. So in the book, Victoria, you really include a lot of work from social scientists, sociologists and anthropologists. And you gave us a little glimpse of that in the beginning of the interview. When you were talking about, you know, presumed incompetent and Black feminist sociology and Audre Lorde and, you know, and so, you know, you include this research that talks about inequality and how it's perpetuated. And you, you know, bring this together with your lived experiences. And as you were saying earlier as well, you know, the university is a workplace just like any other workplace. But so people might think, well, these are the same problems that one would have elsewhere. But I was thinking part of what adds to our frustration is that within the university, at least within certain departments, we actually study inequality and these kinds of marginalizing practices. And, you know, particularly like if you're in a social science area like sociology or like anthropology, or if individuals don't study it themselves, we're generally familiar with this literature. However, it seems to have little bearing on how departments and schools and individuals, you know, act, right? We continue to perpetuate this inequality. And so I wondered if you see within social science and sociology these potential seeds for acknowledging and challenging inequality in the academy, and also if you wanted to talk about, you know, how you bring in this literature into the book.
Yeah, I mean, that's a heavy question. I definitely think that there are seats for acknowledging and seats for challenging inequalities. I think that they are so incredibly limited by so many things, right? So I'm very involved in the profession. I really love service work. I am a sociologist. I'm very involved in the American Sociological Association and other associations. And, you know, I see people trying. And the problem is, right, that it's not about individuals. It's about the structure, right? It's about thinking of what gets rewarded, right? And what gets rewarded is, for example, in works, is to be novel, right? So let's say publishing in top journals in a discipline. What gets rewarded is what's seen as novel, and that itself is racialized and gendered, right? And the exclusion of people who have long talked about, you know, topics are excluded. It takes a lot more work to read. It takes a lot more work, you know, and I'm sure that, you know, I'm always constantly reading, and I'm always, I don't know, this again goes to my like inside self, you know, little girl who's like, I'm not, you know, like I'm not worth anything. And like, nothing I do matters, and I'm never good enough, is that I'm always like afraid I'm missing something. What am I missing? Who's reading this? Who, you know, who am I citing? You know, that's part of why even in my first book, I cite from a wide range of fields and disciplines, but that's not rewarded, right? Like what's rewarded are claims to novelty within a particular, for example, subfield, without thinking about how other people outside that specific subfield have written about the same thing, right? Like that takes a lot more work. And it's also about, you know, reviewers. I think that there is like a lack of empathy, you know, that there's this huge lack of empathy because academia is so driven by the individual model. I also think particularly, and not in an essentializing way, but particularly for white faculty and white men faculty, but also white women, is with as faculty of color, other marginalized faculty, you know, enter in and get challenged. Okay, I'm not really making sense because like I'm trying to think of too many things. But what happens is, and I'm not the first one, I reread, what is it, Pedagogy of the Oppressed. And I used to teach a teaching sociology course for grad students, and I assign it. But he talks about it in that book about how any check of power to the oppressor, they experience as being oppressed. And I think that's what you see. Right? That's what you see in kind of these so-called debates of cultural or debates of so-called culture wars, right? Where they see any check on accountability as a way to discriminate against them as, you know, white men or whomever. And so that's where, you know, I mean, this is a classic sociological insight, is that people hoard and they make exclusions and boundaries, and, you know, challenging that and challenging the structures where the people in power benefit from those same structures is really hard, right? It's really hard. And it takes work. It takes a lot of work, especially in the US when our, you know, US culture is so like neoliberal. It takes a lot of work to kind of be more community oriented, to be kind of thinking about how do we actually change inequities. And honestly, like sometimes people just don't want to listen, right? Because they feel like it's taking their power away, right? Because the problem is not how do we change inequalities. People have been talking and talking about how to change inequalities for a long time, right? But these are the very same people who are excluded from the academy, who would have been. It's the problem is that people don't agree. People don't want to lose out on their power, right? Or have checks on power. And that's where you see these faculty who say, oh, academic freedom and diversity is, you know, impeding my academic freedom. There is literally someone in who wrote an essay about that in my former department. Even I read Inside Higher Ed probably every day. And there was even a story today, I think, about Amy Wax, who is a law professor at Penn, and Jonathan Zimmerman, who is an advocate for free speech, right? Often kind of faculty need to express, et cetera, et cetera. What I found really interesting in his article was also this delineation behavior, right? And that people use academic freedom as a cover to be discriminatory and racist to individuals. And I've seen that a lot too, right? And so it's this veneer of academic freedom means you can't question anything I say, right? Anyway, I'm going on a big tangent, but I think that there is so much opportunity and there's seeds for acknowledging and that there are moves being made. Like, I think that yes, there have been kind of ways to move forward, but there's so much structurally, culturally, that it's hard because as I write in the book, like it's not just policy, it's how policies are implemented and who's in power to implement it and how hard it is to kind of actually, when you do bring things up to admin or an HR or something, you get in, you know, nothing really changes, right? So it's really difficult. And so you see a lot of faculty, particularly faculty of color, women of color, leave academia. And so people get pushed out or they get pushed out of disciplines, right? Like I feel pushed out of sociology and not even in sociology in the broader discipline. Like I really love sociology. I tell, you know, graduate students that, you know, sociology is so much bigger than your department and you need to make these connections and friendships and writing groups. And that sustains you because there are people who see your value and worth. But sometimes when we're in a department and that's not what we see, it's hard, you know.
Mm-hmm. No, definitely. It's like we have to take our own work into account, like take it seriously and implement it on ourselves, which is a challenge. And all the other complexities that you laid out in the answer as well. It's a really, really difficult kind of minefield that we're in. And so I guess that takes us to the final chapter because you've talked about like possible the literature and these possible seeds for transformation. And the final chapter on academic justice kind of calls for us to like hope and imagine and enact these practices that combat exclusion. And you detail these different areas of academic justice and research, teaching, and service. And so I wondered if you could talk about your call for academic justice and if you wanted to maybe give, you know, an example from one of the areas of what you mean by academic justice.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not the first one to talk about academic justice. Even sociologists for Women in Society, another professional association I'm pretty involved in, have a whole committee on academic justice, right? Like there's a long kind of history, particularly of women of color who are long talking about this. And I actually rewrote this entire essay to center it on Black feminist sociology that just came out, I think earlier this year, like in January maybe, and I read it and I just thought it was so inspiring that I rewrote this essay to kind of center the call for a loving sociology, to what does it mean to listen to Black women, to what does it mean to, you know, have empathy and to kind of joy and also just treat each other with respect and dignity. I mean, for me, all of these different practices I outline, that's at the core, is to treat one another with respect and dignity. And why is that so hard? It shouldn't be, right? But that, I think, is at the core, and that gets back to the love and worth. And so, you know, often, you know, we get peer review and, you know, I'm on publications committees and I see this, and we think that dealing with racism and sexism in, for example, publishing and journal articles is intractable, right? Like, what can we do? What can we do? Actually, there's a lot of things we could do, and things that people have already written about, like Cope, or like, I cite this one person who gave a webinar, National Center for Faculty Diversity and Development, who is a journal editor and outlines all of these practices, right? It calls on a lot of extra labor from the editor. But these things about, like, if you receive a review that is steeped in racism, sexism, and not in necessarily the overt ways people think of, but in the ways in which, like, the subtle ways or how things are evaluated as and dismissed so easily, right? That there are ways, like the editor, you know, if they don't want to ask the reviewer to change anything or to think about tone or et cetera, that's fine. But the editor can say, don't listen to this person, or I understand that this is problematic. Don't pay attention to it, or it's some acknowledgement, something like that would go a long way, right? Besides, like, who are you asking for reviewers? I mean, that's the other thing. You're asking for reviewers, people who are gatekeepers, who think that more for other people is less for themselves. And those are the people tend to, right? Like, not everyone, obviously, but tend to be the ones who are making the decisions, right? And you see kind of these notions of worth or notions of work just dismissed, right? Like, even in when I'm on any kind of panel, right? One of the things I try to do is, you know, you have to be an advocate for research that people easily dismiss. And often that is research about marginalized communities by a marginalized scholar, whether that's faculty, grad student, et cetera. And you have to do the extra work to be an advocate and explain and translate. And that's not okay, because some people just dismiss it, right? You know, and I've had experiences in the review process, and so have other people. But there are different ways in which, like I said, the editor, peer reviewers often get to read other reviews too, and they can call it out, send a message to the editor that they thought this other one was really inappropriate. And it means having hard conversations. And, you know, people, I think, have a lot of ego. And so they don't like to kind of, they get very defensive about, you know, whether it's their reviews or et cetera. But in that paper I was talking about, I talk about we need to have intellectual humility, and that should be at the center, right? That we are infallible. I make mistakes. I have been called out, you know, like, and how do we respond to this? And it's not about doubling down, being defensive. You know, I think you probably know the term DARBO, which is, sorry, I always get this wrong, defense, attack, reverse, offender, victim. That's something that comes up in sexual harassment, sexual assault, et cetera. I think that comes up in instances of racism. Gendered racism and sexism is, again, these, like, when you explain why, for example, something is problematic, you get people to be defensive or they attack. And so anyway, but there are ways in which, right? Like, the answers are out there. There are guidelines, and it's about having hard conversations, or it's about what kind of scholar do you want to be? What kind of editor? What kind of person? What kind of teacher, right? Like, I think that, you know, we don't really get training on how to teach, but teaching is so important, and it's devalued. It's not just unvalued, it's devalued. But in fact, like, teaching enhances our research, I think, and our research should enhance our teaching, that we shouldn't dismiss or look down upon people who are invested in teaching, who work with undergraduates, right? Like there's this hierarchy mindset that kind of diffuses all around academia. And that's where it's like a workplace, right? I think getting back to what you said before about, you know, we study inequality, or many of us. And so why do we perpetuate it? And we think that the university, our profession, should be exceptional, but they're not, right? There's lots of nonprofit organizations that, you know, that are for gender equality or for anti-racist. And yet people, the structure of the organization perpetuates these kinds of things. And so I think that we really need to grapple with kind of how to do it. And it takes a lot of work, right? Like it takes a lot more work to write a thoughtful review. But the, you know, some people have said, oh, well, we should do away with the second R&R, or maybe we should just do away with the R&R or something like that. And I'm like, the problem is not second R&Rs, right? The problem in kind of the review process is people, because I think getting rid of the developmental model will only further hurt marginalized people who don't have access to elite training how to publish things, that I think mentorship is an important part. And the problem is, like, reviewing doesn't count for anything. It doesn't count for anything, right? It doesn't count in our merits and promotions. And if it does, it's the quantity, not the quality. Same thing with mentoring. I mean, I talk about in this and in another chapter about how anything can be spun, right? It could be spun to praise one person and devalue the other, right? And that's where, you know, calls for mentoring. D.A. Harvey Wingfield has this amazing book called Flatlining, and it's about medical profession in hospitals and kind of racialized tasks that Black doctors and nurses take on. And one of the solutions is mentoring, right? We should have mentoring. We should formalize mentoring. I think that's great. I've also experienced where mentoring can be toxic, right? And I think you can see that in recent tenure denials that have been high profile. It's because people use mentoring as a way to continue toxic behaviors of dismissing, oh, you shouldn't do this, you should do that. Ethnic studies is not, you know, is not real, quote unquote, social science, or it's not real research, or it's devalued. Or it's like, you can use mentoring as a way to bully, right? So it's not the necessarily the solution. Right? Or maybe we should just reward people who are doing the kind of service work that the university relies on. And teaching, it's about how do we go about our syllabi? So this gets back to what I was talking about before, and I know we have to wrap up with this teaching. We don't get training on teaching, so we don't really follow pedagogical good practices because we don't learn them. We don't know how to evaluate it. So it's sometimes, you know, either toxic or even just like, I don't want to say bad pedagogies, but just kind of old fashioned pedagogies just get enacted because that's the way it's always been. But in fact, an academically just approach would talk about and read literature on pedagogical practices, would read about kind of and enact, you know, bell hooks, teaching to transgress, and thinking about all of this work, even, you know, what best teachers do, that they are kind of, there's this one thing where, you know, in my teaching, I often allow students to revise and resubmit their assignments. And why do I do that? It's because they learn that way, right? You learn, you get feedback, and then revise. And that's also, it mimics the real world, quote unquote, and even our own workplace. We have a way in which we revise our work, and that's where you learn. So anyway, so those are some of the things, and service and paying people for service is one way. It's not the only way, but as someone who, as a solo parent, you know, have to hustle for money, that always is helpful. So those are just a few of the ways. And it's also in how we just talk about people's work, how we approach our reviews, but also our working groups. You know, the best working groups I have are mostly women of color, Black women. And guess what? We start off with each person and we start off what we love about the work, right? The potential, the great things, right? And then our job, right? Our job, quote unquote. But what we want to do is, how can we help you make this piece shine even more? Maybe it's to get engaged in that. Maybe it's to engage that. But often people are taught that their purpose of reviewing, whether in, you know, the classroom or whether in journal reviews or anyone else, is to poke holes and to tear down, right? Like that's the training many people received. I didn't. I had some good mentors at Princeton, Viviana Zelzer in particular, in some of her economic sociology classes, enacted this pedagogy of care and looking for and highlighting the potential. And I think I valued from that, right? Like I've published in some top journals and it's because I've had reviewers who saw the potential, right? And helped me. And that's how I was able to do that. And so I think like we need to approach people even in our teaching and our service and in our research holistically and with respect and dignity, right? With care. Because we're all humans, you know. I'm teaching just to kind of, and you know, I'm teaching this summer for the first time two classes. One of them is Asian American women writing themselves, and it's great because I get to read a bunch of memoirs I haven't read before. But it's about just seeing people as human, right, and approaching one another with care instead of in competition, right? That's not the way forward. The way forward for academic justice is centered on care.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And that chapter was full of so many really practical insights that can be implemented in various different ways. And you just shared several different, you know, aspects of that now that anyone could easily implement, you know, in their reviewing processes, etc. So I thought that was really wonderful. And so my last question is about who you think should read the book, I guess, and what you would want them to take away. And I say that because these conversations about, as you've mentioned, about exclusion in the academy have really been increasing. And, you know, I don't remember them as much happening when I was a graduate student, and I feel like I could have really used them. And so I wonder, conversations involve everyone, not just marginalized faculty. And so I wondered who you wanted to read the book and what you wanted them to take away.
Yeah, well, and I just want to echo that there's a lot great coming out. And one that recently came out too is Community as Rebellion by, and I don't know if I'm pronouncing her name right, but Lorgia Garcia Pena. It's very similar in terms of thinking about community and academia and talking about her experience and tenure denial at Harvard. And I think that's great on top of, you know, all of these long lines of books. But that recently came out, so I just wanted to mention it as well. You know, sometimes this question gets framed as like, who did you write it for? You know, so I'm going to answer that first, even though you didn't ask me, sorry. I really wrote this book for me. As I mentioned at the beginning, I wrote this for me because I needed to, because it poured out of me. Like, I look back, I'm like, I don't know how this came out. I don't know. I feel like I was in a trance. I don't know. But I needed to process. I needed to think. I needed to write. And so now, you know, as I'm thinking and I get asked, who's my audience, which is another way of who do you want to read the book? It's hard because simultaneously no one, everyone, but probably the first set of people would be other academic outsiders, right? Whether undergraduates are so amazing. I got my start as an undergraduate and doing an honors thesis, and I was also involved in like ethnic studies stuff and kind of opening my eyes, you know, to a little bit of the university. And how to become a more just world, because I actually think some of these practices is about academia, but it's about a workplace, right? It's about a workplace wherever you are and treating one another with respect and dignity and care. I think it's for other people who are, you know, on the tenure track, right? Trying to get tenure, who are postdocs, grad students, who are trying to get through their program, who are facing all of these, I found great mentors, right? I'm very lucky. I found two mentors in particular who are just really wonderful. And I could not have done graduate school without those mentors or without my cohort. And many people don't have that. So it's about recognizing, it's about a mirror to show that you're not alone, because when you are the subject and the receiving end of gendered racism all of the time, you could feel gaslit. But actually, and this is where Twitter, there's a lot of problems with Twitter, but part of it is you can connect with one another. Another problem is people then retaliate for, people who share things on Twitter. But it's a way to connect. So it's to facilitate connection, or even precarious faculty, lecturers, adjuncts, people who are in community colleges. I think also people who are tenured should read this, right? Especially people who want to enact change. Because I think the longer you're in academia and the more you go up the ladder, you're increasingly, you can become, you don't have to be, you can become increasingly distant from the challenges grad students face, both white graduate students and graduate students of color. And so it's like a reminder, because people, I think everyone can make changes, right? Grad students, undergrads, adjuncts are much more limited, tenure stream faculty, but tenure people are the ones who have the power. And if they really want to change things, they can. I'll tell you who this book is not for. This book is not for those people who don't believe in microaggressions, who will just read it and dismiss it. They probably wouldn't read it anyway, right? So it's not for them. But I think, and I hope that anyone can take away, most people can take away, whether it's a mirror, feel validated, feel like you belong. You are here. You belong here. Your insights are good enough. Your insights, you are good enough, right? And we need you. And so that's what I would want people to take away. And also to not wait until you're in some mythical position where you think that you don't have any problems, right? To enact change. That actually there are ways we can enact change, and we can create communities starting now. We don't have to wait, right? We can be, I know this is kind of hokey or cliche, be the change you want to see, but it is, right? Like who's around you and drawing boundaries and making those and finding connections. I will tell you that I would not have survived this pandemic or anything without the people in my life who aren't at the student institution. They are academics. Most of my life is academia, but they're the reason that I've been able to get here, right? And I'm so lucky and I'm so privileged. I've had people who are mentors, whether peers, those who are in positions before mine, those who are, more advanced than me, peers, all of them. And I think that we have to kind of create the communities we want to see and realize other people are already doing it, right? Realizing it's not just you alone, and it's finding people who see your value and see your worth already and want to bring you in.
Absolutely. Lean into those spaces where you are wanted and feel more comfortable. Absolutely. And I know that, with everything that you said and everything that you've written, people will go out and read the book and really get a lot from it. Absolutely. So we have come to the end of our discussion. I've been speaking to Dr. Victoria Reyes, the author of the book Academic Outsider, Stories of Exclusion and Hope, published by Stanford University Press. Thank you so much, Victoria, for writing this book and for sharing it with us on the podcast.
Oh, thank you so much for having me and talking with me and being very kind and patient with my tangents and sometimes losing the threads of my thought and having to find my way back.
Oh, I've really enjoyed it.